Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Greetings from the hill country of Central Texas. This is the Revolution in Military Affairs podcast. On today's episode, we welcome my friend Bill Murray back to the podcast. Previously, we spoke with Bill about strategy. Bill's previous episode was one of our highest downloaded episodes, so I thought I would have Bill on again, since he seemed to resonate so well with the audience. I hope you find today's conversation enjoyable, engaging, and thought-provoking. Enjoy. All right. Welcome back to the Revolution in Military Affairs podcast. Today, we have Bill Murray back with us. I have the distinct pleasure of welcoming him and welcoming Bill back. I love getting to talk to Bill. Hopefully, we didn't burn too much of the conversation and the talk before we started recording. But Bill, thanks for coming on today. I appreciate you taking some time out of your evening for you. To come on and talk today.
Yeah, Amos, it's great to be on again, and to brush up on this episode to make sure I didn't repeat myself. I listened to our old podcast, and I think I said back then that this podcast was going places, and I think you told me today like it is taking off. So excited for you, so excited for this podcast, and for all the listeners to get involved in some of the discourse.
Yeah, we're doing pretty good. So I appreciate that, and let me tell you, to get the mood set, I. This morning went for a drive and smoked a cigar, was listening to ZZ Top as I drove through Central Texas here, so I don't think there's much that you can do to get better set for a good conversation. Tomorrow I'm going up to Fort Worth to watch NOFX as last show in Texas, so it is awesome. That's awesome. Can't wait. Looking forward to it. I saw him last year in Austin, so super excited. And in no way, shape, or form is that related to what we're going to talk about. So with that, I guess we'll go ahead and get started. Yeah.
Do it.
All right. So first thing, Bill, I want to talk to you about, and for the listeners, we're going to be all over the place probably a little bit today. We're going to be nerding out today. Today's conversation is probably going to be focused a lot on theoretical aspects. So if you're not a theory person, then this conversation may not be for you, but it is certainly for me and certainly for Bill. So with that, Bill, question. Why is it that Western militaries seem to think that speed military operations is inherently better than other variations of tempo?
Yeah, Amos, I think, you know, tying back into, why speed is better, I think it ties into some of how our military leaders grew up, the schools they attended, and the theory of war that, you know, the United States and the West kind of adheres to. And, you know, that common theory of doctrine, if you're going to introduce something new, you have to work against that, right? So if you and I introduced a really good new theory, we have to fight an uphill battle of what is kind of seen as being right? And people like speed in warfare, you know, getting back to the initiative and superiority. People think that, you know, through speed, they can maintain those things. And I think we're still chasing that Napoleon decisive battle, right? Like, I want to get there quickly and destroy that army. And using speed and that theory can get me that, right? The problem is, like, you know, you talk about a lot, you know, the enemy wants to stay alive. They don't want you to get there quickly and destroy them. Looking back on lessons learned, I think we learned lessons that teach us that speed matters, right? And when you look at the pros behind that, it gives you everything you want, right? And in my mind, I imagine Billy Mays, right, selling me on speed matters. Like, do you want to destroy a nation in a matter of hours? Then offensive speed doctrine is for you, right? Or if you have you up there talking about siege warfare, right? I don't want that. That's going to take forever. If you have me up there talking about some attrition and big defenses slowing down tempo, no one's going to buy what we're selling, right? But if you're selling speed and destruction quickly, you're going to get people on board. You know, some of the cons behind this, right? You really have to look at the terms and conditions of that speed war and maneuver focus, right? I think some of our assumptions are pretty far off base. And, you know, can we do the things we say we can do? Yeah, I don't know. Some of it's tied into environment and a lot of other areas. When you look at some of the middle ground in this, right, I really do think the most dangerous lies are the ones we tell ourselves. And we can't be one-trick ponies. You know, if we got really good at offensive operations and just combined arms warfare, that's really hard. But then we'd be one-trick ponies, and we can't do what we need to do, right? Iraq, Afghanistan come rolling around, right? Counterinsurgencies, like, oh, we don't do those. Like, what do you mean you don't do those? Like, well, yeah, we just drive fast. That's what we do. Like, that's not what we need to be able to provide the American people.
Dude, we I couldn't tell you how many times I heard speed equals security when I was in Iraq.
Yeah, I mean, it can. But the second you slow down or pause, then you no longer have that. That's the problem, is you can't.
Well, what's funny
that.
Too is, like, an IED didn't really matter how fast you were going. It's still going to blow up on you, you know?
Yeah. It's funny. I remember one of the platoons that I used to roll out with, they drove fast. And I asked them, it was their scout platoon. I was like, why do you guys drive so fast? I'm like, oh, we're going to drive past the explosion. I'm like, I'm a combat engineer, man. Like, that thing's, that explosion's going like
physics says that
fast.
Doesn't work. Yeah, I'm no rocket scientist. However, that's not how that works. Yeah. So a couple follow up questions. So first, love the Billy Mays thing. The Billy Mays tie-in's terrific. I wish you could have done a Billy Mays impression. I don't know how that would have worked. I don't know if you get a Billy Mays voice, but that would have been great. I don't even remember what he sounds like anymore. In my head, it's the guy with the I know it's not him, but the guy with the what is that spray stuff, the boat, you know? Yeah,
and you slap it on.
Yeah, that guy. That's fountain. The picture that keeps popping in my head, but I know it's not him. It's the other guy. Didn't he have a beard? Yeah.
Yeah, he had the beard. Yeah.
Billy Mays here.
Billy Mays here. I've got maneuver right. operations.
Yeah.
Buy one
Iraq and you get an Afghanistan. Or I guess it would have been buy an Afghanistan, you get an Iraq for free. All right. That would have been terrific. I think I'm going to figure out a way to make that, tie that into the podcast down the road. So anyway, the two things that I think are interesting to ask is as we talk about speed. So Western militaries like to emphasize the importance of speed in their operations and in the concepts that we develop and in the doctrine and in how we think about war and warfare. But at the same time, and I think that this is where there's a divergence and perhaps it reflects a lack of connectedness in how we think about everything that we're working on. So this idea that I've been calling standoff warfare, this idea of killing the enemy far remotely, not with physical troops in close proximity, right? And that's done through long-range fires, precision strike, drones from afar, and from using proxy forces in closer proximity, right? But it's all standoff. It's not you physically having your own forces close in close combat, right? So that – in itself is it actually works against speed. It works against fast tempo. At the same time, that whole idea of strike as a strategy, do those two ideas, that standoff warfare and strike as a strategy, do those in your mind seem to reflect a dissonance between this idea, this emphasis on speed, but then the way that we're actually approaching war as we're moving forward in time?
Yeah, and in Amos, I think we may be looking at, you know, strike as a theory of warfare, because the old maneuver as the answer can't answer all the questions.
Whoa, right?
If we want to influence a region,
come on now.
if we want to do something in Yemen, right? Like putting a ground force in there might be able to accomplish the mission. We'd be putting a lot of lives at risk, and maybe it can't get what it wants, right? So I think we're seeing some, evolution in a theory of strike. I think you've seen this a lot too in our doctrine. We're getting, more and more focus on the deep strike and less on the close fight, right? Which I found really interesting. Your last podcast with Mike Kaufman talking about, hey, a lot of these engagements are inside 10 kilometers, right? Which, congratulations, you can shape the enemy deep, but it doesn't matter with that 10 kilometers. So I think you're seeing some of that strike focus, and then how can we tie that to our maneuver warfare? And I think they may be a little bit disconnected right now. We the theory and technology haven't really caught up.
We'll follow up, sir. So it's funny that you mentioned you could do these maneuver things in these other places, but it'd be costly. I was once in a conversation, and by conversation, I mean getting talked at, with this unnamed three-star, who's now not still a three-star, but higher. And he said, and I quote, "There's a maneuver solution to what's going on in Syria." And I remember laughing, not out loud, because I would have probably gotten in trouble, but to myself when he said that, because I was like, what are you talking about? And so this idea that there's a maneuver solution to everything is just comical sometimes, because we can't get out of our own way when it comes to the mental bias that we have, and the idea that like we can do exactly what we think we want to do in every situation, which goes back to the speed argument. And then to tie in Mike's points on that deep and close to what you just said too, it's very germane what you said and what he said about, and it's something Franz Stefangatti's talked about and written about too, like the deep area perhaps may be less relevant moving forward, especially in situations like you see in Russia, Ukraine, where once forces converge, they're really, there is no deep area, and it's all close area, just varying degrees of close area. And so when you look at the force structures of, Western militaries, we tend to be gutting close combat forces at the expense of deep combat forces, for lack of a better term, right? We're gutting, just like in the U.S. Army, for instance, we're gutting BCT level forces for theater level forces like MDTS, right? We're cutting out combat engineer capabilities, for instance, over the next several years, and ground cavalry formations for to provide numbers for things like the multi-domain task force. So we have overhead to fill things like that. And so it's just interesting, reality shows, empirical evidence, it shows the need for one thing, but we're generating space overhead for something that shows something else. And so, there's arguments perhaps, hey, that's being done for a different threat scenario in a different theater. Okay, that makes sense too, I guess. But at the same time, realistically speaking, on the ground, real world situations show that perhaps you should still be building, resilient combat capable forces for the close area.
Yeah, Amos, I think you're talking perfectly right. I think some of the problems we're having right now, if you look at our force, when was the last time we developed a weapon system for maneuver forces that really kind of helped us dominate that the close fight, that 10 kilometers? I know the Army just came out with a really cool mortar system, fully automatic mortar system. It
looks
really awesome. But what
else is out
there? Strikers
dominate in the close area?
Yeah. The striker's great to get there, but to cover the last couple clicks to the front, like, you're just running and you're walking with your stuff.
Well, that and, you know, the striker's just like 40-year-old technology, too, that we just renamed.
Yeah. We can get places quickly on regular roads, on regular bridges. Yeah. So there's a beauty to it. I think you're right. I mean, there's a lot of focus, right? Because things that kill people and the enemy far away, like, they're also expensive, right? And those companies like to sell their equipment and promise, hey, you can kill the enemy 100 kilometers and you don't even have to worry about the close fight. You know, maybe they're they're the true building bases of this whole conversation, right? Selling us what we think we need. But, you know, the truth is, like, that close fight in 10 kilometers really does matter. And we need to, you know, focus a little bit more on some technology in that realm. Yeah. And we've talked before, it's not the little hobby drones that are going to do it. That little thing, doing a suicide mission into the side of a tank, that's really cool, but you need mass, you need big things to kill lots of vehicles and lots of enemy. So I think focusing on that, and then tying in some of the problems that we're talking about, is tying in some of our doctrine. We haven't been very good about bringing it all together. We were developing kind of a deeper strike. The close fight doctrine really hasn't changed that much since Airland Battle, right? It was in 86. So things have changed on the battlefield with sensors. I think it's time that we relook all of those things very carefully. Maybe go right to the whiteboard and start from scratch instead of, you know, you said it last podcast, like coming, you know, having the old doctrine out there and just slapping down a point, 2.0 and making it feel new.
Yeah, I think the other thing too that's overlooked in all this is that there are inherent challenges in land warfare that, what's the word, endure. I'm pulling out my land warfare challenges that endure paper here that I think are worth highlighting real quick since we're on this topic. And I will lead with the end and then go back to it at the end. And so it's important to remember that land forces it requires a land force to defeat a land force because these in land wars, these challenges are enduring, right? And so armies must be capable of taking or retaking territory, period. Right? Armies must be capable of clearing an enemy army from a specific piece of land, period, right? And so, like, Ukraine, their army has to clear Russia's army from its territory to regain that territory, period. No questions asked. They have to. An army must be capable of holding territory, right? So in the Russia-Ukraine scenario, Ukraine's army must clear Russia's army from its territory, and then it must be able to hold that territory against Russian counterattack, and hold that territory and not be pushed off of that territory. And then armies must be capable of protecting populations, right? They've got to protect the people in the areas that they're holding the territory. Armies must be capable of encircling a hostile force, right? That's also part of that, part of the key things that they have to be able to do. Armies must also be capable of holding a hostile force in place. And then the last one there is they must be capable of sealing boundaries, right? So if they can't protect their borders and seal their borders, then they're always going to be prone to invasion. And so those challenges, those seven things that I just mentioned, are enduring challenges in land warfare, and they're inherent. They're never going to go away. As long as there are land wars, those are always going to happen, regardless of technology, regardless of drones and sensors and battlefield transparency and all of that. And so when we think about, and I say all that to say, when we think about force structure and the evolution of war and all that, like, those things have to be central to when we think about armies and tactics and operations and strategy and force structure development. And at the end of the day, like, it's going to take a land force, not things being shot from the sky, because when things are shot from the sky, and this is why I think drones and all these new long-range fires, precision strike, those aren't game changers. I think if you just take the novel words out of it, all it is things being shot from the sky, right? That has existed in war for a long time. So if you just think of it as that, right, things being shot from the sky, not a drone, not a long-range fire, not a precision strike, what has always happened when things are shot from the sky? The people on the ground usually just go underground, right? And then that develops a static front. For the most part, right? And then when you get a static front, what does that entail? That requires that army to do many of the things that I just described, the seven things, right? And so it develops this dynamic. So that's why I say a lot of this technology isn't game changing. It's actually evolutionary. It's just it continues the cycle of war that we've seen for, you know, at least 100 years, World War One at least, in terms of how we see war evolve. And so I say all that to say, I don't know, I got off the point. You said something cool, and then I kind of went down a rabbit hole. Deep, close, eliminating the close source. Oh, you know, so that's why I think it's important. We just have to remember that, like, as we think about future force development, we can't forget the fact that close combat forces, whatever the term is you want to use for it, like, those things are critical. And as we think about future force development, you can talk about human machine integration all day long. That's fine. And like, we can take people out of those forces. That's fine. You can put robots in there. You can put, you know, human machine teams. You can do it however we want to do it moving forward. But like, those things have to still exist, right? Like, it can be robot forces that go through and do those seven functions that I mentioned.
Yeah, it doesn't matter,
right,
as long as it's.
But if there's something hostile sitting in your territory, something has to go in there and take it out, period. And it's not going to be rockets from the sky.
Yeah. And we've talked before, right? We know that, you know, in the U.S. military, we're taking some capabilities away from brigades, right? They're getting a little bit smaller, and we're moving that up to the division level when, I got it, we can't have the army the size we wanted. But like, I think I want really capable brigades.
Yeah.
that can make sure that the close fight's taken care of. And hopefully we can do what we need to do in the deep fight. But at the end of the day, like, it's going to be won or lost in that close fight with the brigade. So hopefully that brigade that's fighting is really, yeah, you know, really well resourced, which I think some of my concerns, yeah, are with the new force structure.
Yeah. I mean, talking about that really fast, and then I'll jump to the next topic, just talking force structure really quick. Seeing the RSTRUC, the Army Force Structure Memorandum that came out the other day, or I guess it's been like a month ago now. It's, you talk about taking things out of where it should be and putting it where it shouldn't be. You look at the the SFAB realignment, and it's like cutting the thing that does the thing and putting it in the headquarters. You know, it cut one whole troop and like part of two other troops, right? So like 33% of what actually does the work in that organization and put it in the headquarters. That was a shocker to me. But anyway, you don't have to comment on that. I just was somewhat astounded when I saw that the other day.
Yeah.
All right. So next question. What are some of the challenges that Western militaries overlook when they're advocating for high-tempo operations?
Yeah, I think some of the challenges are when you're looking at the mentality, right? So I think you very much have this like, well, it worked before mentality, right? Like, it took Germany 6 weeks to defeat France. It took the U.S. 4 days to destroy the fourth largest army in the world in Iraq. So people get focused on that. And we've talked before that, you know, doctrines created to solve old problems. The problem is, like, you know, war is not repeatable. It's not a science experiment. But if you did repeat it, you know, it's not a promised outcome. If you want to know what that looks like, look at Napoleon winning until he's not winning, right? Because the enemy's learning.
And
he doesn't
want
to be destroyed anymore. Or the Germans in World War II. Yeah. Or the Germans in World War II, right? Like, it's really easy to keep winning maneuver warfare until you can't do it anymore, almost like a magic trick. Not every environment allows it either, right? If you look at, like, airland battle, you know, it was really built for Germany for a specific time. And a certain, you know, political will at the time. And then you put that into the desert in Iraq, and like, it's even easier. It's a cleaner battlefield. I'm not saying like deserts are easy, but it's not the mountains, rivers, and forests of Europe either, right? So I think environment matters a lot. You know, the enemy doesn't want to die. They don't want to be destroyed. So they're going to counter whatever you're trying to do with your high tempo operations. I think capabilities, we probably don't talk about that enough, right? Maneuver warfare, it is hard to do it, right? Can we do the things we say we can do? Joint fighting is really hard because in combined arms war fighting, gap crossing, breaching, you know, I'm in a workup right now with the 2nd Cavalry Regiment, and I think we do it better than anybody else out there, humble brag a little bit. But it's tough to move 1,400 kilometers to Poland, Lithuania, disperse, execute a live fire, right, and then return. how many other countries can replicate that, right? So now if I'm Billy Mays, I got some terms and conditions that might not work for everybody. I think it's even hard to replicate that in our own army. And then gap crossing, like, you know, I was in Korea with the 11th Engineers, Jungle Cats, and gap crossing is so hard without being shot at, right? So how do you do that to support your, you know, your increased rate of tempo on the battlefield to make sure that, you know, the maneuver forces don't stop? Because like you said, once they stop, they're vulnerable. It is really hard. I think also, you know, we've talked before and for the audience, right, like operational reach, it is a great term. We should talk about it more. In my mind, in some old doctrine, it was combined, you know, operational reach was made up of protection, endurance, and momentum. And the winner of operational reach found the way to balance those really well. And then when you didn't do it, it was called a culmination, right? But I was actually thinking through this problem set. And when you're focused on tempo operations, you're really just focusing entirely on momentum, forgetting about protection, forgetting about endurance and logistics, right? Like you're just focused on going. And if you want to look at what kind of like a good tempo looks like, right, compared to what was a really fast tempo, you know, it took Germany 6 weeks to take France in World War II. It took the U.S. and allies 11 months, right, to defeat the German army, which was pretty well defeated. And the main focus, right, was out on the Eastern Front, right? So which side do we take to our doctrine, right? We chose the Germans' high tempo is the great way to do it, not the slow, meticulous, balanced way that the U.S. and allies partners did, where we really did manage protection, endurance, and momentum really well. So I think when you look at all those factors, those are some of the challenges that you're going to face if you're looking at, you know, working against the tempo speed operation.
Another thing on tempo that I think is overlooked too, there are multiple aspects to tempo, right? Tempo doesn't just mean going fast. Tempo is a scale of speeds, right? And so you can go varying speeds. And tempo is something that you should use to your advantage based off the situation, based off your own capabilities, based off the capabilities of an adversary. And I always like to use, again, because I coached football before I came in the Army. And as a football coach, you know, I was an offensive football coach, and we used to, you had screen passes and football and trap plays, and those are plays that you use to vary tempo a lot of times and to slow things down and to take advantage of the defense. You know, you would let them use their own speed against them, right? So, like, if you're running a screen pass to a running back, for instance, you're trying to take advantage of the defensive pass rush upfield, right? So you'd let them come barreling upfield real fast. They would be thinking that they were going to make this great sack on the quarterback, but what you're really doing was you were luring them into a trap, and then you would just dump the ball off behind them to the running back who was, you know, using slow tempo, right? And then you'd dump the ball off and then go, theoretically. if the play popped the way that it was supposed to, you know, and the linemen would set up and sort of slow play the defensive line as they were trying to rush upfield, then they'd release and they'd get out with the running back and then set up a wall for the running back to run behind. And I think that that's, in my mind, when I think about manipulating tempo, because this is what I think we don't do collectively, the Western militaries, when we think about this, we just think about going fast. We don't think about the manipulation of tempo. We don't think about the manipulation of anything. It's either all or nothing when it relates to anything. And this is why we have this maneuver fetish, and we have this speed fetish, and we have this precision fetish. We don't think about the manipulation along a scale of anything. It's just all or nothing. And tempo is the same. And, you know, we need to think about the manipulation of tempo, much like a screen pass. We think about going deep every play. We think about hitting a post route against cover two, right? Skinny post against cover two every play, when, like, dude, sometimes they're running cover three and that's not open. You need to be running like a screen pass against this strong pass rush.
Yeah, I mean, and, you know, to your point, I think we have to have a well-developed playbook, right? Like, if even, you know, Nick Saban can go to a high up tempo spread offense, like, the U.S. Army can look outside of just maneuver doctrine. Like, we can look at other ways to make sure that we're resilient, and then, you know, we have other things up our sleeves. I think we can't turn into an Oregon team, right, where we're just spreading it out and we got no run game behind it. So I think looking at that through that, you know, kind of that metaphor is good. We need a little bit more to our game than just that maneuver warfare speed focus.
I was hoping you would have said the Big Ten. You know, if the Big Ten can go from 3 yards in a cloud of dust to spread offenses exclusively, then anybody can. But, you know, it's all good. I'll let that slide.
Yeah. Yeah. But Nick Saban was pretty mad. Remember, like, yeah, I mean, because he was a defensive guy and he didn't like the defense.
Yeah, well, Nick Saban gets mad about everything, so.
All right, Amos, I'm going to turn the table on you, and I'm going to introduce a question. And this goes back to something that we've been talking about for about 7 years. And you and I originally started right after we graduated from SAMS. We were chatting about some theory things, and we were both interested in some Shimo Nave, where this idea of how do you win a war without actually fighting the decisive bloody battle. So we traded some ideas back and forth, which was a really fun time, and I've really kind of thought about those ever since. But so my question to you is, pathway operations, all right, that is a novel idea moving through military circles today as an alternative to defeat mechanisms, which, as the name applies, is a mechanic approach to operational and tactical warfare in a systems dominate period of conflict. How can tempo be nested within the pathway construct to maximize success in wars characterized? And Amos, if you could explain what I call the Amos web of Amos web of
pathway. What do we operations? Call
it? Yeah, pathway so, operations.
So I think the first place to start when thinking about this idea. So it's a lot to. I hate the phrase unpack, but I'm going to use it. It's a lot to. What's another way to say unpack? It's a lot.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
To explore, because there's several layers of ideas here. So I think a good place to begin is with Trevor Depew, who I think is an underappreciated military theorist from the 20th century. And his work on the idea of defeat is really important. And so he has a book called Understanding Defeat, where he talks about defeat from beginning to end, everything that you could want to know about the idea. And he has some empirical work in there that is really useful. But in there, he outlines three basic causes of defeat. The first being unfavorable circumstance beyond the control of the commander. Second being unfavorable circumstance the commander may influence. And then the final being failure to command. And so I think that those three elements are essentially things that you can influence, you being a very amorphous idea, but a military force being the you in that situation. So if I say you moving forward in this discussion, you is the military force. Yeah. And so in that situation, you can influence those three factors, right? And so at the same time, you can also counterbalance those against yourself. And so those are the starting points when thinking about how to build military operations, both offensive and defensive, right? So you can insulate yourself from those factors and then also build offensive operations that focus on generating defeat oriented on those yep. factors. So trying to affect unfavorable circumstance beyond the control of a commander, unfavorable circumstance that the commander cannot influence, and then making the commander unable to command. And so with that, you know, we've got the defeat mechanisms, which already exist in military doctrine, as a good starting point to deviate from. And I say deviate from because right now I think that, as we've talked before, and I've talked with other people on this, if you go back to the Christopher Tuck episode at the very, very beginning of this podcast, we talk about systems thinking and systems theory. Yep. Modern militaries are systems, right? And systems theory applies to modern militaries and how militaries operate. And again, like we talked already today, they operate in accordance with those principles, the first being stay alive, the second being try to win. And then as a part of all that, you know, they're open dynamic systems. They learn, they use feedback loops, all those things. And so because of that, they are not mechanistic. They're systems. And so because of that, that's why the mechanistic idea needs to be removed from defeat mechanisms, and we need to scrub that off, and we go with a web idea instead, because these ideas are webbed together in a network type fashion. When you move off of that, you have to also think about the fact that we're no longer in a mechanistic era or a mechanistic age. We're in an information age. And we've already talked about tempo, right? We've talked about how time is important here. And, you know, throwing out a bone, I'm pointing over to my books like people can see, but throwing out a bone to Robert Leonard. And
I can see him.
You know, Robert Leonard and Fighting by Minutes, you know, the importance of time in the art of war cannot be underestimated. And again, Bonaparte, we've already talked about him, but that's one of the key things that he talks about as well. And so you have to factor that in, the manipulation of time, both proactively and whatever the word is for slowing it down, but those have to be factored in. And so I think that you can apply within this web, this defeat web, that focuses on Depew's three factors or three causes of defeat. You can develop this time pathway that has four elements, right? Two of which are positive and two of which are negative that you use to manipulate, going back to the phrase I was using earlier, manipulate time, right? So you have hyper and frenetic, right? So fast and, or what is it? Hyper, which is fast, and frenetic tempo, which is, hyper and chaotic, which is frenetic, and then hypo, which is slow, and then sequenced, which is pulsing, right? So different sets of frequency for time. That you can use to manipulate time, right? And those are things that you use intentionally to try and do different things, to try and manipulate time in different ways for different results. And those, I think, are intentional manipulations of time. All right, so there's that pathway. And then, again, going back to the idea of the importance of data and information in the information age and the whole idea of systems theory and systems thinking, data being the critical element there, especially because of the importance of feedback loops and the network and the feedback loops and the feedback networks. You've got the information pathway, and within there, that has four elements, right? And so it's confuse, poison, overwhelm, and deceive. And just like the time or tempo pathway, those two are manipulated, right? And purposefully manipulated. And so within that, you've got all three of those pathways working together, and you manipulate each of those pathways together within that defeat web in whatever manner you see fit based off the situation, based off, and again, I know the enemy falls within the situation, but based off the situation to achieve defeat, generate defeat against the enemy. And I know that's a lot just talking, and like I'm looking at a chart that I made. So it's a lot more challenging, I think, to not visualize, to try and visualize it in your head without seeing the chart that I'm looking at. And if I'll look and see if I can somehow link the chart.
I think I can explain it simply for your listeners, right? So for the listeners, it is a web with kind of some main branches of the web going out. And the main branches is what Amos is kind of speaking to, right? So like the destroy, isolate, dislocate, disintegrate, they're kind of going out at, you know, let's say 45 degree angles. And then within that, with the data, you have the poison, confuse, deceive, and overwhelm. And then, you know, in between those, you have the time-based one. So if everyone kind of visualize a spider web with the main branches coming out.
No, that's
is that
good.
Helpful?
I'll see if I can share the picture too. I may be able to like Google Drive it onto the notes from the website. But anyway, that idea in a nutshell, I think is you seen what's that movie called? Old School, where Will Ferrell's debating James Carville. I think I just did that and I forgot. Yeah, I forgot the question.
He blacks out. Yeah. But Amos, I think that's perfect, right? So I think, you know, where you're going with that, right? I think there is a place for this in when you're thinking about, I think absolutely at the operational level, a team could sit down and think through this by phase. They could look at enemy capabilities, enemy actions, and kind of think through this. And I think it applies to the tactical level as well. And that's why this kind of really spoke to me, because, you know, what does changing doctrine, or, you know, how do we adapt to what's going on right now? I think, you know, the physical has always been there. I think data, I think there's a little more, there's, you know, the ability to confuse, poison, deceive, and overwhelm. I think we might be getting more of that because of technology, right? And then the time's always been there. So how can you influence kind of operations and, you know, doctrine by what we're kind of learning? And I think this fits really well, better than anything I've seen.
Yeah, and this also...
you know, the co-action
development. Yeah, and this gets to the idea that you were talking about too, about, and I also acknowledge that it's probably almost nearly impossible to do, but this gets to the idea of trying to defeat an opponent without actually out having to fight them. When you think through the effect of data and information here, you know, if you can somehow affect data to the point that you've crippled them before they can, I'm going to use air quotes and say uncoil, you know, if you can cripple them through data means before they can get themselves out there. Part of it too, this is something down the road that I'm working on, is that I think this also presents the opportunity for ways to reorganize, or think through ways to reorganize how to array the battlefield in a framework, right? And so when you think through this, I also think that you can lay out the battlefield in such a way that you set it up to almost be, if you think about how, so going back to the point on, you know, win or survive and win, right? Those two things being first and second in the order of precedent. Survive means you're hiding your cards, right? And so, like, militaries always move. Yeah. You know, if your military is not deployed in a place knowing that it's not going to bump into something, right? And so it's always moving. And I know that's a generic term, but I'm just using it generically on purpose right now.
Yeah.
It's always moving, knowing that it's going to bump into something. And so it's moving in a way that is protective, right? And so if it's moving in a way that's protective initially, you need to cause it to move. You need to trip the mousetrap, right? You need to cause it to show its hand early, before it wants to, right? And so you have to do something to do that. And so you need to array the battlefield and array your operations in a way that causes it to do that without causing yourself to do that. And so as you think through how you array tempo and you array data on the battlefield, because I think that that's something that in the near future we'll be able to do, is array tempo and data on the battlefield. As we array that on the battlefield, we have to do that with that in mind. It's not how do I shape the deep area. It's how do I align tempo and data in such a way that I cause the enemy to show his hand so that then I can then defeat him. Because this is the other thing too. Like, I'm all for like getting in that close fight and fighting the close fight. But if you can defeat them before they even get into the deep area, then defeat them before they even get into the deep area.
And I think what that looks like, right? Like just very simply for data, especially like you could have a unit moving up into position, right? Just totally black on comms. No one's saying anything. And then you could come alive for 10 minutes and then turn that off. And you could transmit fake data. You could have emitters emitting all, you know, you could make a brigade look like a division and you could just make it all turn on and then turn it off. And I think this is really like with your, you know, what I'm calling Amos's web, this is the only way right now that I know of how to institute this into the planning process is through this kind of by phase and when, you know, how do you manage that at you know, kind of
actual. What you were talking about is exactly what I was thinking too, in terms of how to get that in there. Same thing like spoofing organizations, like you mentioned, you spoof this and that and you make things look like they're there when they're not there. And, same thing with sensors, you drop sensors here, you drop sensors there, you're generating all this information as formations move through and you're able to pick up what's coming through well before it actually comes through there. So what else on that one, Bill?
Yeah. I kind of want to go back to kind of the idea of catalysts, right? And I think your theory is a little more well thought out than mine. But, you know, as we were talking through, like, how do you win without fighting? Like, the idea of a catalyst came to me and you know, what, you know, the definition of a catalyst, a thing that precipitates an event that causes great change, right? In my mind, you know, that great change would be a country deciding that they don't want to fight in a war anymore. When you look at things, you know, what would cause them not to want to fight anymore? Military losses being too high, it's not worth it anymore. Exhaustion of resources, public pressure, right? And I think public pressure can come from lots of directions. I think human suffering can be part of that, right? I think we learned a little bit in previous wars, like in World War II, the bombing in London actually wasn't enough to make the people quit. It actually made them stronger. But history is full of examples where you can make the civilians population suffer enough that it will cause public pressure to end the war. I think there's international intervention is something that can convince a country not to go to war, and then leadership change. So as I look at catalysts, right, that, you know, how do you win without destroying that nation? I think of ways that something would occur to influence those areas to convince a country that it's no longer worth it, right? So in my mind, as I think through what's going on with Russia and Ukraine right now, right, we talked a lot in the last podcast about Crimea. And if you look at the what used to be the Black Sea Fleet, one of my officers called it the Black Sea Yacht Club now because they've had so many ships destroyed. I think you're looking at, you know, can they make military losses high enough where Russia quits? I don't know, but they're trying that strategy in Crimea. And then if you look at what they're doing right now on Russian oil refineries, I think they're getting after the natural resources, right? They're going to try to exhaust resources to make Russia second guess the war. So when you get away from the tactical and operational side of the house, right, now you're kind of looking at a strategic. What are some strategic aims? You know, Ukraine is in a stalemate. What can we do as a catalyst to get Russia to second guess whether they want to be in this war or not? So it wouldn't blow my mind, right, if on some whiteboard in Kyiv right now they got some of those things up there and say, how are we influencing these things to get Russia to decide if they don't want to go to war? You know, this goes counter to some of our discussions. You know, we're not big centers of gravity people, right? Because the enemy can change your center of gravity in complex and adaptive systems. But this kind of does support that idea that there is potential to do some things to convince a country that it's not worth it. But again, like those are political decisions as well. So I just wanted to kind of tie that into, because I think what we're thinking about is, you know, I think the catalyst might be at the strategic side. And I think what I'm calling Amos's web kind of resides on the operational and tactical side. I don't know if you
agree
with that or not.
What you're describing almost feels like a Hail Mary to me. So to use another football metaphor.
Yeah.
It's not even center of gravity. It's like man, we're gonna just try something and hopefully something works again. Because I saw some people, I don't know if I'll call it negative feedback on Twitter, saying that I was banging on Ukraine. I'm not banging on Ukraine. I do hope that Ukraine wins. I just don't think they have the capacity to do what's required to win, which I think is removing Russian forces from Ukrainian territory.
You're ultimate realist.
Right.
You're
an ultimate realist. So, like, I think, like, outside of, like, even that, like, so, like, what you're saying, Bill, like, okay, they do that, but then what? You know, like, Russia's not going to withdraw from Ukraine. They may throw up their hands and say, okay, we're done, but they're not going to withdraw, you know, and then the war is over, but Russia still holds, you know, those three huge chunks of territory, the Donbass, the land bridge, and Crimea. So, I mean, it could work in that regard, but that's still not a win per se for Ukraine, depending on what Ukraine considers a win. So, I don't know. I mean, it's a catalyst for the war being over.
Yeah, I mean, I think. Yeah, I mean, I think that's, you know, I think the theory that I'm kind of explaining is a little bit of a Hail Mary pass, and I'm trying to explain some stuff in hindsight, right? Like, yeah, the two nuclear bombs on Nagasaki and Hiroshima, right? Like, we didn't destroy military targets per se, right? They're, you know, they had some military value. I got it, but like, they were definitely a catalyst to end the war. That didn't lead to, you know, there wasn't the destruction of the army, right? We talked before about the Madrid bombings in Spain, you know, leaving the wars on terror. That was a catalyst for them to leave that war. So, I think looking back in some hindsight things, and I, you know, there you could also add in there's some catalyst to precipitate wars, right? Like
9/11. Pearl Harbor.
9/11, right? But I will also say countries, unless you get invaded, countries don't go to war unless they want to go to war. No one is forced into those things. No one, that is a political thing that people want to do and they choose to do that. No one, unless you're invaded, you really don't get forced into a war.
You got me. I don't have a good answer for you, man.
Yeah.
You're smarter than I am on this.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, if you look at some of the you know, the original air campaigns, right, in World War II, what were we trying to do? Like, we thought we were trying to strip away some resources and things like that, but we knew that aerial campaign wasn't going to lead to the direct defeat of Germany, right? I think in looking at that, can we waste away or cause someone to use enough resources in that, you know, at least in the Germany thing, where they decide it's not worth their while? But again, like, yeah, I mean, political will is a strong thing, so the will of the people.
Yeah, that, and it's one of those things too that there's always this bases of power are a tricky thing, right? So there's known bases of power, there's latent bases of power, and then there's unknown bases of power that always end up getting mobilized at some point along the way. And Robert Dahl wrote in like 1957, and he wrote that he's the guy that came up with that theory that power is A, making B do what B wouldn't otherwise do, right? And part of that is the idea of bases of power, right? And being able to mobilize bases of power. And that's where this idea, I mean, I don't know if he originated the idea of latent bases of power and all those other bases of power, but this is where it's hard to measure some of these ideas about catalysts, right? And so this is why I'm kind of wishy-washy on what you're saying, because I think, you know, like we saw with Russia, and you know, I talked a crap ton about this whole Russia-Ukraine conflict. I know you and I both spent breathless nights at the beginning waiting and watching to see how it was going to unfold and to check on Zelensky's well-being on Twitter to make sure he was still tweeting, to make sure he hadn't, you know, that he was still okay and everything. But yeah, man.
Country hadn't fallen.
Part of that conversation too was like, oh, any day now Russia's going to fall apart, you know. Weeks would go by, then months would go by, and I remember thinking, what the hell's going on? And then finally at a point where I'm like, and I went back and reread Dahl's paper, and I'm like, oh, yeah, you know. And you started realizing, and you started seeing in the news, like, you know, this country's helping Russia now, this country's helping Russia now, Russia's mobilized this thing, Russia's mobilized that thing. And it goes into that idea of bases of power. And bases of power help overcome a lot of these ideas that we think may be catalysts, right? And we're like, we're going to throw these economic sanctions on Russia, and it's going to cripple its economy, or it's going to cripple its military's ability to do this. But then we forget that, you know, there are latent bases of power that are lurking. There are emergent bases of power. Like, who would have thought North Korea would come to Russia's aid and provide it, you know, whatever the number of shells was that it provided the fact that they worked or didn't work is irrelevant.
Yeah, it may have been naive of us. Yeah.
But the fact that they were there to do that, you know, and who knows what else they're providing. I know people do know, you know, I don't know, but there are intelligence organizations and others out there that do know what they've provided. And I'm sure it's been things on the battlefield that are proving effective, you know, and so all of that has prolonged the war and toned down the, and this is part of the reason I think centers of gravity are BS, you know what I mean? Because it's people in a building on a whiteboard sitting there thinking they're the smartest people in the room, working through this corny ass heuristic that they were taught in a staff college on, you know, these are the things that if we go in there and just touch are going to make the system fall apart. And that's not true, man. Like, what are the bases of power that are that you don't even know exist? Like, who knew North Korea was going to do that? You know, and again, like, North Korea's help may have been marginal at best, but that's just an example to help illustrate the point. And so I say all that to say, like, the things that's why I'm kind of wishy-washy on the catalyst idea. I think it's this is something I think, like, would be cool to sit and just on the side later chat with you about more, just to kind of, like, kick around and develop more, because I do think it's interesting.
Yeah, we've talked about it a lot before. Yeah, we've talked about this before, right? I think we came to the same conclusion, right? Like, yeah, maybe. Because, you know, and I think it goes back to, our, you know, is there a way to win a war without defeating the enemy, right? And that kind of stemmed. If there is, it has to do something with this particular theory, the theory of like a catalyst, kind of at the strategic level. Does that mean it is a viable theory? I don't know. Like, you know, if you try to prove something by things in the past, like you recall some things, but I think the only way that you could potentially win a war and not destroy the other country's army is through some sort of catalyst, right? Like public support, right? Like if you want to talk about why the Taliban, got the U.S. out of Afghanistan, there was a catalyst on the American side where the American people decided, this isn't our thing anymore. Public pressure, right? It took a while.
20 years.
Kind of going back to that. So I think if you look at it through ways like that, it's an explanation to that. I mean, you could look at Vietnam the same way. Public pressure led us to get out. There's other catalysts involved in the process too. But yeah, I think if there is a way to win without destroying the other nation's army, it has to.
I think it's more of a men who stare at goats type situation with Billy Mays sitting there selling it real hard.
Maneuver warfare.
Who stare at goats is really. I mean, if you think about it, it's a cognitive process focused on the mind. It's a mental paralysis. You just drive around them really fast, really hard, and then they just throw up their hands and are like, oh, God, you got me. Yeah. Totally, totally being facetious, because I know right now people listening are like, he doesn't understand maneuver warfare.
It doesn't help, though, right? Because they can say Iraq in four days, right? Like, oh.
Yeah, you got me. You can. There's always an out with that, man. You got me. That's right. Third ID, which I would say is just a frontal attack along a single line of approach, but whatever. All right. Yeah. I don't know, Bill. Speaking of operational reach, have we culminated, or is there anything else you wanted to hit before we go?
No, Amos, I really appreciate you bringing back on the podcast, right? I know we hit a lot of theoretical ideas. Hoping people will get excited about that and think a little bit more about it. But I think specifically, right, with like your Amos's Web, I think that, you know, that gets a little bit beyond theory and into some operational and tactical planning that, you know, if you kind of, like I said, you post that web up, I think some people could take that and they could apply it next week. So I think there's something to that. And so, it wasn't just a theoretical discussion. I think there's some actual, like, real application that people could actually execute with that today. And if anyone in Ukraine is listening to my catalyst idea, just let me know. And that's the Murray catalyst idea. So,
all right. Well, I will once this posts, I will have figured out a way to get the, as Bill said, the Amos Web posted in the show notes. I'll. Hang on. I'm looking at your notes, Bill, and I see Jim Powell voice in the background. What was that in reference to?
Oh, yeah. That was in reference to I got a lot of great feedback, right, from the first podcast I did. Some of the stuff was I had some really great leaders get back with me. And one of the things was like, I never thought that doctrine was created to solve old problems, right? Like, and they told me, like, you know, I think our doctrine is really based on some strong, sound ideas. And that's when the Jim Powell voice came in my head. And what was it that Jim Powell used
about
to
say? Doctrine? He said a lot of stuff.
No, he used to say, like, how did you, it was something along the lines.
Oh, yeah, yeah. He would lean back in his chair. This is my favorite. And I'm going to butcher it now since you asked me to, you put me on the spot. He would lean back in his chair, start rubbing his chin,
yeah,
and say, I'm going to nail it now. On what basis did you make that assertion? And then anytime he said that, you're like, oh, God. Oh, God.
I'm writing that down now.
Yeah, because then you had to be on your A game because you're about to get nuked.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of assumptions in our military that we're making, right? And I said it at the beginning of the podcast, right? The most dangerous lies are the ones you tell yourself. So I think there's a lot of people have ideas that really aren't based on anything. And if you know Jim Powell was there, he'd give them that.
I completely agree, and that was so for real, man. That's like that line runs through my head so many times when I hear people talk, when I sit in meetings and I hear people say things. I'm glad that I saw that note right before we finished, because that's like the perfect thing to end on, because that really did. Like, I remember, I won't name the name, but at the beginning of the course at Sam's, I was standing up there next to a guy who was like the OPT lead, and I was his assistant for the first exercise. We don't call it the stunned mullet exercise. And Schifferly was Schifferly was like punking him. And then Jim Powell was sitting there with him. And then I had said something and I was, you know, still in the, like, you can BS your way through anything phase, you know, didn't realize Sam's was like the first course you couldn't do that in. And I had said something and Jim Powell leans back and starts stroking his chin and eyes start squinting and I'm like, And then he said, on what basis are you making that assertion? And I was like, oh God, I've got to come clean. I don't know. But after that, I heard him say it all the time in the course. And that was like the, your moment of truth with the man, you know, and you had to be able to like defend yourself or get, and you know how he was. You never got yelled at or anything, but he got politely scolded pretty hard.
Yeah, I mean, he wanted dialectic, right? Like he wasn't arguing, but he was searching for truth with you. And if you didn't,
he made you feel stupid, and it wasn't.
Yeah, he wasn't tolerated.
Like for me personally, I never. It wasn't like insulting in any way. It was always professionally developing in a positive way, but on a personal level, as somebody that doesn't.
Yeah.
Doesn't like feeling stupid. I was always like, oh God, he got me, you know? But anyway, so I've rambled on long enough, and it's always good reminiscing about great lines by great people, but that's kind of the essence of this podcast summed up too, you know, like on what basis are you making that assertion? That's one of the underlining ideas behind this whole endeavor here. In addition to giving me something to do.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks, Bill. I know it's getting late there. I'm going to go hit the road and smoke a cigar. It's 85 degrees here in Central Texas, so I'm going to take the top off my Jeep and go smoke a cigar.
Amos, enjoy the day. Really appreciate
you
inviting
me. Talk again soon. Thank you for listening to the Revolution in Military Affairs podcast. We know that there are a lot of other podcasts out there competing for your time, and we appreciate you sharing your time with us. If you like what you heard today, we would appreciate it if you would share this on social media. We would also appreciate it if you would provide us a rating on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. These ratings help new listeners find the podcast. Thank you.